I was just thinking, if I was going to talk about the differences between me and George Bush, we'd probably be here for the rest of the century. So I'm going to talk about what I have in common with George Bush. I'll tell you what that is in a minute. But first of all, I'd like to say I'm very pleased to be here. I'm honoured to be here, to be speaking to the Order on this occasion, or not all of the Order, but some of the Order on this occasion. And I really mean that. It's a pleasure to be able to talk about something which is really meaning to oneself, and hopefully that it will spark some resonances in other people as well. So it is a great pleasure for me to be able to talk on something which is close to my heart. Because I'm talking about something which is close to my heart, I also need to issue a health warning. I've done this on a few occasions recently, and I find it's very useful, because I'm going to be talking about something which I feel very strongly about, but which also occasionally pushes people's buttons. Yeah. Now, I get enthusiastic when I talk about things that I'm interested in, and I'm not very diplomatic. So I sometimes say things in a kind of rather perhaps raw way. I mean, I don't understand this, but apparently people too sometimes get a little upset at what I say. So I'm just warning you in advance that if that happens, it's not intended. I don't mean to do it. It's just my ignorance, my failure at diplomacy, my inability to be able to be sensitive in my speech. But I'm not going to try and do anything about that, because if I did, it would spoil the whole thing. So health warning, if you want to leave, you may leave now. What do George Bush and I have in common? We have one thing, as far as I can know. No, two things, actually. We both lived in Maine for a while. But the other thing is that we're both passionate about freedom. We both believe in a way that freedom is the most important thing there is. Now, our understandings of that word freedom may be quite different, but at least we use the same word. Herein ends the comparison with George Bush. I've always loved freedom. Now, I've not been particularly faithful to freedom. Many times I've wandered from her arms and I've gone into other ways. Over my life, I've begun to realise that she is my true love. I've recently actually been reading The Faerie Queen, the first book of The Faerie Queen, the story of the Red Cross Knight and Una. And I can relate to that so very, very strongly. One day I'm going to give a talk on that book and relate it to the whole quest for freedom, which is what it's all about. Anyway, freedom is a demanding mistress, but she's unerringly faithful herself. I may wander away into other arms, but she is always there waiting. She's incredibly demanding, though, but she does repay her demands for more and more, by ever greater and greater happiness. This is my experience. In my teens and early 20s, I loved the physical freedom of hiking in the countryside, in the English countryside. Later on, I loved the freedom of travelling around Europe, particularly hitchhiking around Europe for the summers. I developed a kind of attraction to social nonconformity, as well, I think, as an expression of this desire to be free, desire to be not constrained in any way. And on occasions, I even had perhaps rather confused glimpses of a far deeper freedom, a freedom actually from myself. This is freedom, this desire for freedom has often, I think, been expressed in the pull of homelessness. The idea of wandering with just a rucksack on your back, you know, and everything in your rucksack, your tent, your cooker, your food, your clothes, your books, everything in your rucksack, just wandering through the countryside. That was a wonderful feeling. I have actually lived in tents for, not intents, but in T-E-N-T-S, in under canvas, on many occasions. I've lived for many, many years in caravans, both in England and in the United States. I've lived in huts. My hut at Gigaloka is my love. And also at the moment, I'm living in a narrowboat. A narrowboat is a small place, but it's also something you can move around. You know, you don't have to be stuck in any one place. You can live in the country in the morning and move into the centre of the city in the evening. It's the same sort of sense of freedom. So I'm a bit of a gypsy. I've recently discovered that my mother's family come from Mercy Island, and that they were bargees. They used to go up. They live on their barges and went up and down the Thames, carrying goods. Maybe it's in the genes. I've also had two loves. Call them the two Marys. They have other names, but for the moment, let's just call them the two Marys. This is, of course, the Virgin Mary and Mary Magdalene, the whore. The Virgin and the whore. These have been my two loves. Let me explain how these relate to freedom. Who's the Virgin? The Virgin is pure, beautiful, refined, delicate, delightful. The whore is wild, unrestrained, energetic, vital, exciting, ecstatic. Now, these two feminine figures, I think, represent two aspects of freedom. Now, throughout my life, I've mistaken them. I've looked for them in the wrong place. And I think you can all guess where I've looked for these two women in my life. I've looked outside. I've looked at human beings. I've looked at females to try and find these unions. But again, as I've got older, and hopefully a tad wiser, I started to realise that they're not human beings. The two Marys are not human. They're symbols, they're expressive of higher states to which I've always really aspired. So on the one hand, the purity of the Virgin, beauty, delight, refinement. On the other hand, wildness, nonconformity, ecstasy, freedom. And I think these are two aspects of the experience of freedom. When I met Bhante and Buddhism, I was immediately attracted by the taste of freedom in his teaching. I remember it very clearly. And as many people say, I don't think I was converted to Buddhism. What happened? I discovered that I was already a Buddhist. I don't know that I can say and always had been, but I definitely discovered that I was a Buddhist. Buddhism, it seems to me, is the path of freedom. In his talk on the taste of freedom, Bhante, of course, points out that the Buddha says that the ocean has but one taste, the taste of freedom. The ocean has but one taste, the taste of salt. And the Dharma Vinaya, has one taste, which is the taste of freedom. We also find in the last two links of the positive nidanas, we've got liberation and knowledge of destruction of the biases towards bondage. So clearly Buddhism is about the quest for freedom. In the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha says to Ananda, he's talking to Ananda, he says, this is the deathless, this liberation of the mind from craving. I'll read that again. This is the deathless, the liberation of the mind through not clinging. Now, of course, there are many dimensions of freedom. And as many dimensions of freedom as there are dimensions of bondage. In fact, we normally talk of freedom in terms of freedom from certain restrictions, from certain bonds, from certain chains that bind us. There are various levels, as I was saying, of freedom. There's material freedom. By this I mean there is freedom from incarceration. There are those people who are physically locked away. Their freedom is limited by the fact that they are held in the walls of a building. There's the loss of freedom that's implied in slavery, where one's decisions are not one's own, they're the decisions of another. We may feel that slavery is a long way away from us, but indentured service was also considered a form of slavery. In fact, indentured service, in terms of people being transported to the United States and then being bound to work, was made illegal before slavery was made illegal. So indentured service is not that much difference in a way from wage slavery. It's not that much difference from having a large debt on your credit card and having to work to pay it off. So there's still, if you like, reflections of that in our lives. We can feel bound by this kind of thing. We can feel bound by poverty. We can feel bound by illness. Now, these restrictions in many cases are not of the individual's own making. It could be argued that karmically they've been produced, but let's not go there for the moment. But mostly those experiences, the experiences of that kind of bondage, is that it's not the individual's own making. And they can often do little to free themselves of those particular chains. I'll be saying more about this at the end of the talk. Secondly, we have levels of intellectual freedom. Intellectual freedom can be achieved by the individual, but there are also very strong social restraints that go against that freedom. I'm thinking here of things like political freedoms, religious freedoms, and so on. Thirdly, I want to talk about spiritual freedoms. Spiritual freedoms are, generally speaking, in the hands of the individual. This is one area where we can really make a big difference. Although, strangely, people tend to engage a lot more with the other levels of freedom and fight for those less readily than they will fight for spiritual freedom. So this is what I'm going to be talking about. I'm going to be talking about spiritual freedom. What do I mean by spiritual freedom? Well, again, I'm going to look at this on three levels. Firstly, there's freedom from emotional attachment. Traditionally, of course, this is said to be freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion. Yeah, well, we all know this. We know that this is what it's all about. Just abandon greed, hatred, and delusion, and we're emotionally unattached, we're free. But it all slips off the tongue just a little too easily. So I thought we'd start off by just reflecting upon what these emotions are that we're trying to be free of. Just to remind ourselves of what we're really talking about, what the bonds are. And I'm going to talk about them just under four headings connected with the objects of these emotional attachments. The first, because it's the paradigm, is women. Women or lovers. Yeah? So make the translations for yourself. What happens when one becomes involved with a lover, when one falls in love? Let's look at the negative emotions. Let's look at the emotions that bind in this particular kind of situation. First of all, there's a desire that consumes us. Otherwise, quite sane people go completely mad. They forget all of their responsibilities. They forget to look after themselves. They forget their friends. They forget their duties in all sorts of various aspects of their life. And they become obsessed on this one particular object. That desire feels pleasurable, but it's actually a kind of insanity. It really is a kind of madness. All of us have had experience of this from both sides, probably. We've experienced the being caught up in that desire, but also we've seen our friends being caught up in it and think how wacky they are, how crazy they are to do this. You know, she's pretty ordinary, really, but, you know, we go quite over the top. So that is a kind of that is a bond. It's being caught by a rein and being tugged somewhere. Later on comes jealousy. That kind of jealousy that sours the whole world. Now I speak from great experience. I can remember once lying on my bed in the room next to my girlfriend's room. She was being visited by a male friend. I was rigid, literally rigid with jealousy, lying on my bed like that, shaking, rigid with jealousy. I didn't want that. Didn't like that. I did overcome it to a certain extent, but again, through my life, there have been great periods where I've just been, my girlfriend only has to talk to another man, and I become very uncomfortable. And it's dark, it's unpleasant, it's a very, very unpleasant feeling. There's nothing to benefit. One's ashamed to have it, one doesn't want it, but it happens. Then, of course, she finally goes off with him, or her, and there's grief. One's then left with grief, the loss, the pain of loss. And one day, she's going to go. He's going to go. Either to another or to death. Even if it's not as intense as this, there's irritation. You know, you've been together for a few years, all the kind of really heavy stuff has gone. You know, she's not going to run off, you know, the passion's gone, but God, she's so irritating. Why does she do that? Why can't I get a bit of space? You know, why won't she just let me go and retreat for as long as I want to? You know, what the hell's going on? There is irritation. Again, a mild form of aversion. Possessions, more general possessions. Let's think, since we're all chaps, let's think of a nice bit of electronics. Yeah? The latest, the last few weeks I've been struggling with a wildfire mobile phone. Shall I buy one? Shall I not buy one? Caught up with desire. I admit it, I should have been writing this talk, but what I was doing was looking on the internet, checking out Vodafone 302, where could I get the best deal, so much stuff. In the end, I thought, hang on, if I buy one, it's going to go wrong sometime, or the battery's going to run out when I need it, or it's going to just cause me hassles. So forget it, just leave it. So for the moment, gentlemen, I succeeded. I have put the wildfire aside and will not be buying one. Here I said that publicly. If you do get it, if you do buy it, there's the fear of loss, isn't there? At least for the first few weeks. You're terrified that you're going to leave it somewhere. You're going to leave your bag somewhere and it's going to go, or someone's going to steal it. There's always that kind of anxiety that it's going to go. And then there is, of course, the actual loss, when the thing breaks, or when, in my case, you drop it in the river. It's a goner. It's finished. And then there's irritation when it doesn't work. Just think of all of these kind of emotions. Wealth. Supposing one has wealth. Again, I think, and I speak from my own experience, the more you've got, the more miserly you become. The more you've got, the more you want to keep it. I used to, when I first came back from the States, if I had 10 quid in my pocket, I felt that was okay. I wouldn't let it go below 10 quid. Then I started getting a bit more money and it went up to 100. And then, I was given some money by my mother, it went up to 1,000. I didn't want it to go down below 1,000. Then my father gave me some more money. I didn't want it to go below 10,000. It hasn't got to 100,000 yet. But sometimes, you know, what you've got, you set a level, don't you? You don't want it to go below that. Why? One doesn't want to do that. There's anxiety about your investments. There's anxiety about what you should be doing with your money. If you've got large amounts of money, you have a lot of worry but you might, you know, not be investing it at quite the right interest, and there's the world, you know, the whole economic situation is a problem. I must move on. I'm getting caught behind here. Reputation. Just think of the things that happen with reputation. We get envious at other people's reputation, and we get resentful when they're praised for their talks, for example. I admit there's certain friends, whenever they're praised for their talks, there's always a little burst of resentment that comes to me. You know, why are their talks praised and not mine? Yeah, it always happens. I've got some control over it now, but it still happens. Oh, to be free of these emotions. This is what we're talking about. But to be free of emotions like this means to be free of the conditions that give rise to those emotions. Therein lies the rub. The Buddha says, sensual pleasures are impermanent, hollow, false, deceptive. They are illusory, the prattle of fools. Sensual pleasures here and now, and sensual pleasures here to come. Sensual perceptions here and now, and sensual perceptions in lives to come. Both alike are Mara's realm, Mara's domain, Mara's bait, Mara's hunting ground. On account of them, these evil, unwholesome mental states, covetousness, ill will, and presumption arise, and they constitute an obstruction to a noble disciple in training here. It's true. Abandoning these negative emotions, which follows from abandoning the conditions that give rise to these emotions, opens the door to higher spiritual experiences. Experiences that do not arise on the basis of sense experience. Experiences such as contentment, delight, ecstasy, bliss, beauty, happiness, profound, imperturbable equanimity. These are the liberations of dhyana. This is the first stage. This is the first area in which we can work through renunciation. By renunciation of the worldly emotions, we can attain the higher liberations, the freedoms of dhyana. But even these sublime states must not become objects of attachment. We also have to abandon what the Buddha calls the best objects of clinging. We have to renounce all objects of clinging by developing wisdom. I'll say less about this, but wisdom comes from renouncing self-cherishing. Wisdom is the freedom from self-cherishing. And this is normally talked about in terms of abandoning identification with the five skandhas. Abandoning this form, ceasing to identify with it. Abandoning my feelings of pleasure or pain. Abandoning attachment to them. You're still going to have the feelings, but one is unattached to them. They flow forward. Abandoning identification with perceptions, labelling, having interpretations of situations. You know, we all have our favourite interpretation of what's happened. Something unpleasant happens or something pleasant happens, we build an interpretation. That's just an interpretation. It needs to be held lightly. It needs to be abandoned. Abandoning our unskillful emotions. Abandoning identification with this consciousness. In abandoning these five skandhas, in letting go of them, in letting them flow on, we are liberated from a sense of self. That liberation is a higher liberation than the dhyanic liberation. However, there's a danger. There's a danger even here in this abandoning of self-cherishing. The danger is that we can relate to that freedom from self as a personal matter, as something that's for me, that's my freedom, my liberation. It's clear that this interpretation is incorrect. That the experience of freedom that comes from abandoning the five skandhas is not experienced just as a personal liberation. Although before that liberation is experienced, it can be seen as such, and one might find oneself aspiring to that kind of purely personal liberation. The warning that we receive against this is that that is an incorrect interpretation. The correct interpretation is that we see that all things are by nature empty. All things arise in dependence upon conditions. And seeing that all things arise in dependence upon conditions is an expression of a deeper understanding of that liberation that comes by abandoning the five skandhas. And this liberation, of course, is the liberation of the fully and perfectly enlightened Buddha. I'll be saying just a little bit more about that later on. So from what I've been saying, it's clear that freedom comes at a price. Freedom and insecurity are two sides of the same coin. If you want freedom, then you have to have insecurity. You have to let go of things. Freedom does not come unless one breaks the chains that bind. The painful bonds are not so hard to renounce, although perversely, for some reasons, we tend to hold on to painful situations rather than to risk the uncertainties of freedom. Pleasurable bonds are harder to let go of. We need some kind of confidence that if we're giving up our pleasures, we want something better. And this does not always appear immediately. Renunciation seems to be most successfully practiced if one moves from pleasurable to even more pleasurable levels of existence. This is clearly described in the Pali Canon. There's the story of Nanda, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. Nanda is losing faith in the spiritual life. The Buddha takes him up to the heavens and shows him the nymphs that serve the god Shakya, I think it is. He sees these beautiful nymphs. Having seen these beautiful nymphs, he completely forgets the beautiful woman who's been pulling him away from his practice. So, I must say, having caught a glimpse of those nymphs myself, I must say that I think they make even the most beautiful women, who've been beautified even by Dyer Rich's hard work, look like mutilated monkeys with their ears turned off. Yeah? So, and that's true. The beauty, the refinement, the delight of the nymphs is far, far greater than any human woman could ever provide. In the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha says to Mahanama, "Even though a noble disciple has seen clearly as it actually is, with proper wisdom, how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering, and much despair, and how great is the danger in them, as long as he still does not attain to the rapture and pleasure that are apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that, he may still be attracted to sensual pleasures. But when a noble disciple has seen clearly as it is, with proper wisdom, how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering and much despair, and how great is the danger in them, and also he attains to rapture and pleasure that are apart from sense pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that, then he is no longer attracted to sensual pleasures." The Buddha then goes on to say that this was exactly his experience before enlightenment. He couldn't have renounced the pleasures of the world unless he discovered something greater, something more pleasurable, the pleasure of contentment, and also something more than that, which is, of course, the pleasures of insight, of wisdom itself. So letting go of the world can seem a rather unattractive or bleak prospect, unless we've got some clear experience of the more positive rapture and pleasure of dhyana to move towards. So the path of freedom is a path of renunciation. This is not a popular topic. I think it probably never has been. I discovered a wonderful statistic a few years ago, which I quoted frequently, and this is of a Korean Buddhist order, the Chogye Order, I think it's called. They have 11 million members in this Buddhist organisation in Korea. 11 million members. 8,000 of those are monks and nuns. 400, I think it is, of those regularly meditate. Yeah, or take up meditation as a serious practice. Now, maybe that gives us some idea of what we might expect within a Buddhist movement. Yeah. So it's not going to be everybody, even amongst Buddhists, who's going to pursue the delight, rapture, ecstasy, beauty, and exquisiteness of meditation. Why? I don't know. Many suttas stress that renunciation is an important part of Buddhist practice. Oh, I missed out one thing. I must tell you this one. This is what Mr. Chen says about renunciation. Mr. Chen says, the first mistake is not having a foundation of renunciation as a firm base for the practice of meditation. Quite often I receive correspondence from America, and my lay Buddhist friends say that to renounce is easy for people in the East, but very hard for Westerners. They complain that in the West there are so many things to give up that it's made more difficult. To them, I reply that the right thing to do is to lay even more stress on renunciation. If someone finds mathematics difficult to study, the only way in which he can learn and progress in this subject is to make even greater efforts. So it is with renunciation. If we find it difficult, we should struggle and put forth great efforts in order to overcome our attachments and enable us to give them up completely. That's Mr. Chen. In many of the Buddhist scriptures, in many of the Pali scriptures, whenever there's talk about meditation, we get this little stock phrase. It's a simple little phrase that can be easily overlooked. The Buddha says that the bhikkhu, having gone to the wilderness, to the shade of a tree, or to an empty building, sits down, folding his legs crosswise, holding his body erect, and setting mindfulness to the fore. And then he goes on to discuss the particular meditation. It's a little phrase, we're probably all familiar with it, we've come across it, but have we really thought what it means? Yeah, gone to the wilderness, to the shade of a tree or an empty building, sits down, folding his legs crosswise, and so on. In other words, he's gone away from the world, he's renounced the world, at least temporarily, in order to practice meditation. There are much stronger suggestions in the Dhammapada when the Buddha says, not by a shower of coins does contentment arise in sensual pleasures. Of little sweetness but painful are sensual pleasures. Knowing this, the wise man finds no delight even in heavenly pleasures. The disciple of the fully enlightened one delights in the destruction of craving. Or, further on, stronger still, cut down the whole forest, not just one tree. As long from the forest arises fear, cutting down both wood and brushwood, be out of the wood, almsman. For as long as the brushwood of passions of man for woman, for example, is not cut down, so long is his mind in bondage, like a suckling calf to its mother cow. Not only do we find this in the Pali Canon, of course, where we'd expect to find it, but we find it in the Mahayana. In the early Mahayana, in the inquiry of Ugra, for example, there is a description that the layman Ugra asks the Buddha how the householder Bodhisattva and how the renunciant Bodhisattva should live and practice the Dharma. Ugra is told that the household Bodhisattva takes refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. He practices right livelihood and respects and supports his family, friends and servants. All quite familiar, isn't it? He never abandons his efforts for the welfare of others, even at severe cost to himself. At one point it said that he should give away all of his possessions and his money. I must say, I wonder what his wife would think about that. It does cross my mind. He practices the 11 precepts, including celibacy and the complete abstention from alcohol and drugs. He encourages other to live by the Dharma, and then the Buddha encourages him to reflect on the unsatisfactory nature of wife, home, relations, possessions and reputation. The Buddha does this at great length and with such shockingly direct terms that it makes Milarepa look mealy-mouthed. Finally, the householder Bodhisattva is encouraged, in no uncertain terms, to leave all this behind and live the renunciant life of the forest. The Buddha then goes on to describe the joyful life of the renunciant Bodhisattva. Yeah? This is a Mahayana text delivering a teaching to a layman. It's a very idealistic text. It's very direct, very down-to-earth, very practical. But as the translator Jan Natia says of it, it's not family-friendly. Also, we find in later Mahayana, in the Vimalakirti, for example, which also features a layman, that there is a wonderful section, I think it's in the third chapter, where Vimalakirti denounces, basically, attachment to the body, to the human body, and praises attachment to the Dharma body. Milarepa, of course, is the epitome of the practice of renunciation. His life and teachings don't hide the difficulties of renunciation, but they also express the joy that comes from it. He's inspiring because he's so joyful, he's so playful. He delights in his renunciation. For him, it's not a heavy experience. It's always joyful. There's no disgruntlement. In one of his songs, famous songs, he says, "Because I have left my kinsmen, I am happy. Because I have abandoned attachment to my country, I am happy. Since I disregard this place, I am happy. Because I do not wear the lofty garb of priesthood, I am happy. Clinging not to house and family, I am happy. I do not need this or that, so I am happy." And so on for pages. Gampopa, his disciple, says, "Give up enjoyment of the towns and cities and always turn to retreats in the forest. Be single-minded at all times like a rhinoceros, and it will not be long before the best profound absorption is attained." Several centuries later, Tsongkhapa says, "Aim your mind ultimately to practice. Aim your practice ultimately to the beggar. Aim the beggar ultimately to death. Aim death ultimately to some dusty ravine." Sounds dark, doesn't it? But the effect of all this is beautiful, is an ecstatic release. This side of it is expressed much more perhaps by the Japanese, who describe the renunciant life in very beautiful terms. There's the poems of Ryokan, and then there's Gina Mitrage a few years gave me a book called The 10-Foot Square Hut by Kamono Chommei, which is absolutely delightful. Just a few pages description of the renunciant life, of a freedom, a free life. There are many, many other examples, and I don't want to sort of batter you with too many of them. I've perhaps battered you with enough anyway. But clearly, the point has been made, I think, that renunciation is central to Buddhist practice. The Buddha's life itself, he left home. He renounced the pleasures of the Karmaloka. He went to the forest, he learned meditation. He experienced high states of liberation. He renounced those. Sat under the Bodhi tree, renounced the self, and gained enlightenment. There's another renunciation that happened just a few months before his death, which we don't talk about quite so much. In the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, just before his death, at the Kapala shrine, the Buddha told Mara, mindfully and full awareness, that he would renounce the life principle. The life principle is the last bond to be broken. This was the last element of Mara's domain that the Buddha had to abandon. This was the great renunciation, the final and complete liberation of the Buddha. How about our practice? Let's come back now and spend 15 minutes or so on looking at our own practice. Milarepa's happy song, that's what I like to call it, which I've already mentioned, gives a thorough but rather unsystematic description of the dimensions of renunciation and liberation. The main dimensions fall into four areas: desire for possessions and money, attachment to kinsmen and companions, pride and egoism, and desire for any particular place, any home, either mental or physical. To be free, we have to disentangle ourselves from everything to which we are attached, which is a very wide range of things. In principle, this includes objects, people, social connections and status, our own views and feelings, our own body, sense experience, and even life itself. Attachment goes very deep. It's also important to reflect that it is attachment itself which binds us and causes us suffering. Now, this is an important, I think it's an important point. It's attachment itself which is suffering. We often say that, you know, if you're attached to something, you might lose it and then you might suffer. But we need to bring it back further than that. It's actually the attachment which is itself suffering. When we hear about renunciation, most of us think that we're being told to give up that to which we are most strongly attached. Well, it's true. That's what we are being told. That's the message. But we might not be able to do the big things immediately. It might be a matter of transition, doing smaller things first, getting an experience of the freedom that arises from that, and then moving on to bigger and better things. For most men, thinking of renunciation means giving up sex. When we hear talk about renunciation, we think that we're being asked to give up sex. But the issue of renunciation is much more complex and much, much more interesting than this. Remember that in his exhortation to cut down the forest of attachments, the Buddha called man's attachment to woman the brushwood of craving. Yeah? It's not even a little tree. It's not even a bush. There are other bushes and trees and things that we have to work on once we've cleared the brushwood out of the way. But quite often, it's not until you've cleared the brushwood out of the way that you can actually start to see what the real project is. Man's attraction for woman is obviously taken as a model, the paradigm of thirst, grasping, attachment, and consequent bondage, for obvious reasons. But there are many more subtle and serious attachments that come to light as you work towards liberation. Gampopa talks about renouncing the world as renouncing social busyness. He says, the essential characteristic of the world, social busyness, is to be distracted through the company of one's children, spouse, acquaintances, or possessions. Attachment to material things such as food, clothing, comfort, and so on, and attachment to reputation and respect such as other people's praise. Because of such attachments, one cannot get away from the world. So these are, broadly speaking, the areas we need to work. It's important perhaps to remember at this point that the Buddha doesn't teach us to be emotionally cold towards others. In fact, he teaches an intense emotional relationship of loving kindness, appreciation, and compassion towards others. But these emotions are all free of attachment. They're different from attached emotions. So it's easy to say renounce the world, but it's not so easy to do. How do we do it? Clearly, it's a big job. It may seem rather daunting. It may simply seem undesirable and impossible. So if we're going to engage in the process at all, we need to move one step at a time, gradually feeling ourselves, freeing ourselves by letting go. Then on the basis of direct experience of greater freedom, we can take another step. The spiritual life, I would say, could be seen as a process of transforming our pleasures, those offered by the world, to those offered by higher states of consciousness or something more powerful than that, the pleasures of insight and liberation. How does one find these positive states? Well, clearly, a direct answer is retreat, by retreating from the world, by leaving it, by going away from it. We find, as I've said before, repeated this phrase, having gone to the wilderness, to the tree, or to an empty building. This seems to be the automatic prerequisite for meditation. One has to go away from the world. At Guhyaloka, we see this as our particular function. We don't see the retreat centre at Guhyaloka as being a place where we teach meditation, nor as a place where we particularly study the Dharma, although we do those things. What it is particularly, its special purpose is to be a place where you can get right away from the world, completely away from it, physically, psychologically, and so on. This is our speciality at Guhyaloka. Akashavana is very similar, but perhaps these are the only two places that are really dedicated to renunciation in the movement. Shantideva says, one should recoil from sensual pleasures and cultivate delight in solitude, in tranquil woodlands, empty of contention and strife, on delightful rock surfaces, cooled by the fresh sandal balm of the moon's rays, stretching wide as a palace's, the fortunate pace, fanned by the gentle forest breezes as they contemplate for the well-being of others. Passing what time one pleases anywhere, in an empty dwelling, at the foot of a tree, or in caves. Free from the exhaustion of safeguarding a household, one lives as one pleases, free from care. One's conduct and dwelling are one's own choices. Bound to none, one enjoys that happiness and contentment, which even for a king is hard to find. So many people have their deepest, most refined, most beautiful, most blissful experiences on retreat. Not always, of course, but sometimes. Either through meditation or through the experience of something higher. When we see the truth of the Buddha's teaching, we discover what we're really after. It's very interesting to note that many of the great changes in the institutions of our movement have occurred after a number of people have been on retreat together and have come away and decided to change things. This happened a lot in the early days. The first centres, the first communities, the first bright livelihood businesses, these were all generated after retreats in which people decided that they wanted to extend the experience that they'd had on retreat. So the retreat is, as it were, a kind of a source of inspiration and a source of transformation. Coming home from such a retreat, one can simplify one's life. One of the direct experiences that we have on retreat is that we could be most happy when living a very simple, uncluttered life. We abandon the clutter of sense experience and emotional complexity. We have a direct experience of the effects of practicing the third precept. We can support this experience by actively simplifying our everyday lives. We can try to reduce worldly input, reduce possessions, reduce input from the media, including the internet, reduce the intensity of our social lives. If we really want to simplify life, then the renunciation or conscious management of sexual relationships can give an enormous boost to emotional simplicity. I can without doubt say that although I've gained an enormous amount of pleasure from sexual relationships, I've gained far more happiness through abandoning them. We need the contact with spiritual friends to practice renunciation. We need people who can see the value of renunciation. Very difficult to find in this world. It's even difficult to find sometimes amongst one's spiritual friends. They think you're kind of nuts, or that there's something psychologically wrong with you, or that you're running away from something, or all sorts of things. But one needs to associate with people who see the value in renunciation, have experienced the value of renunciation, and can infuse and support one's practice of it. Much of this this kind of Kalyanamitrita, I think, can be found from the scriptures, from the ones that I've been talking about today in the Pali Canon, also from people like Milarepa, Royakham, and so on. But even if you practice it, there are various difficulties. Sometimes you just don't want to do it. Why? What's the point? I'll have another biscuit. You know, you just don't want to give up the pleasures. Because happiness is rather more difficult to catch hold of than quick pleasures. The only way that one can convince oneself is by continually reflecting on it, reading the scriptures, talking to people who are enthusiastic about it, and gradually trying to encourage oneself to do it. Look into your own life and see areas where renunciation is supported. When the gadget breaks, wonder whether one should actually keep on buying them. When the girlfriend, boyfriend dumps you. There's my experience, whenever I've been dumped, which is many, many times, there's two experiences. There's grief and desire to get another girlfriend. And there's a sense of freedom, of being God, released. What we normally do, what I've normally done, is I've focused on the grief. And I've looked for somebody else. What I've done in latter years is I've focused on the freedom. I've pursued that instead. And I am convinced that it's paid off, that it's been a really good decision to just slightly shift. It wasn't easy to do at the beginning, but just slightly shift my perspective towards the delight in the freedom rather than the pleasure of the relationship. There are difficulties. Sometimes it can seem a bit bleak. Sometimes, you know, when you're not in meditation, when you're not meditating, and there's nothing particularly to look forward to, life can get a bit kind of dark and bleak. And I've had some quite strong experiences of that. But also, I think if you just sit with it, if you just be a bit steadfast, if you stay with the bleakness for a while, it will change. It will transform into a sense of liberation. So one has to just bear it, brothers, when that happens. It eventually does dissolve. One has to be careful of seduction. One has to be careful of seeing one's friends, you know, delighting in their new this, that and the other. And thinking, oh, I won't mind some of that, and getting pulled, gradually allowing oneself to be pulled away from one's path of freedom. One also has to avoid people criticising one. You know, there's quite a lot of criticisms, I said earlier, that even comes from the spiritual community. One needs to be careful of that. I'm going to have to skip on a bit now. Doubts arise. You wonder, is this really going to get anywhere? Is it going to give me the liberation that is talked about? When doubts arise, one has to really investigate them, not just push them aside, really, really think them through. Look at it, what is causing the doubt, what's the problem? Again, in my experience, you don't get rid of those doubts by just an intellectual understanding of them. We all know the answers to them, but what happens is that at some time or other, when you've actually experienced the liberation, the doubt is gone. You see what I mean? It's sort of like you can struggle with the doubt. You can't do anything with it. But then you experience something higher and poof, the doubt is just vanished into thin air. Often only to come back, you know, a few weeks later. But we keep at it. So what are the results of freedom? The results are that we move up through the spiral nidanas. We experience confidence, shraddha. We experience delight, ecstasy, bliss, deep contentment, clarity, understanding, disentanglement, disenchantment, and dispassion and freedom. Those are what's on offer. This is what renunciation is all about. The image of the Dakini, which we're all familiar with, is an expression of that freedom. I just want to make a couple points. The pursuit of freedom can be seen as a selfish activity. It can actually even be experienced as a selfish activity. You think, well, okay, I'm free myself, but what am I doing for the world? What am I giving to others? I think it's because this idea of a personal liberation is actually a false one. It's not a true expression of the goal of the spiritual life. It's actually meaningless. True freedom is the way it happens when you're not concerned about your freedom, but you're concerned about freedom, about the freedom of everything, of everybody. So going beyond personal freedom, we're of course concerned with the freedom of all beings. The Buddha's view is the extension of the liberation to all. It's an enormous vision, an unbelievably enormous vision. And this, I think, is the meaning of the Buddha's interaction with Brahma. There's a universalization of this dimension of his liberation. It's gone from just him to being a universal issue, something which he is involved with for the whole universe. And this is the arising of compassion, and it's the completion of the experience of liberation. That compassion can be expressed in the world in a number of different ways. We're all familiar with this threefold, with Reginald Ray's threefold analysis into lay, monastic and forest renunciant. But I want to put in a little word here for another person who I admire, and that is the Pope. I'm a great fan of Cardinal Ratzinger's, or ex-Cardinal Ratzinger's. I have been for many years. What I like about him is he's very direct, he's idealistic, and he doesn't mince his words. Just recently, he talked about the fivefold division of the Catholic Church, and I think this is a very useful division to reflect on within our own community. First of all, there are those that live the family life. Those that live the family life, their duty, as Buddhists, I see it, is to establish a healthy society that provides the conditions for the spiritual life. It provides the basic material freedoms, economic freedom, freedom from sickness, psychological freedoms, intellectual freedoms, and so on. It's the small unit, if you like, that builds a society which could be dedicated to the establishment of these freedoms. Secondly, he talks about the vocation of teaching, secular and spiritual. Teaching, education helps to break the bondage of ignorance, whether it be secular teaching or whether it be spiritual teaching. That's the second role that one could perform. Thirdly, there's the role of charity. And this is where we come back to those in prison, those that are sick, those that are mentally ill, people that can't help themselves. Well, we can do things for those people. We can help them in some way to experience a greater degree of freedom. So this is where work for the poor, the hungry, and those in prison can be practiced by Buddhists. There's the priesthood. Now, we don't have priests, but we do have exemplars. We have people who are living the spiritual life very fully, who live in the world and exemplify that spiritual life. This is what I think is the essence of the priesthood. The priest is someone who brings the word of God, as it were, to the people. For us, I think it's someone who brings the vision of the Buddha's Dharma to the people through their lives, through their activities. And finally, fifthly, the Pope mentioned the contemplatives, those that are away from the world, devoted to pursuing higher values, a visible example of the benefits and desirability of abandoning the world. Now, I think this is a very good sort of selection of vocations for the Buddhists, all of them being directed towards establishing, as it were, an order of freedom. So today I've been emphasising the importance of the path of renunciation as the practical means to find freedom. There is no freedom without the abandonment of bondage. Some bondage seems so pleasurable that we are loath to renounce our attachment to it. But the liberation will always bring a greater happiness. By our renouncing our attachment to pleasure, we can find true happiness. Our confidence in this fact needs to be developed gradually, but faith will grow as we become increasingly free. And I just want to finish with a final word from the Buddha. Thus, Ananda, I have taught the way directed to the imperturbable. I have taught the way directed to the base of nothingness. I have taught the way to the base of neither perception nor non-perception. I have taught the crossing of the flood in dependence upon one support or another. And I have taught the noble liberation. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them? That I have done for you, Ananda. These are roots of trees. These empty huts. Meditate, Ananda. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you.